I'll open it up to public comment if anybody has anything. Going once, twice, three times. Moving on to approval of minutes for April 24th, 2024. Is
Move approval, Madam Chair.
there a second?
Second,
Peter Souza.
Okay, thank you, Peter. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay, motion passes. Moving on to number six, presentations. Alec Johnson, Capital Workforce Partners, President and Chief Executive Officer.
Thank you, Lori. This is Matt, and I just want to briefly introduce Alex. As Lori said, Alex is the President and Chief Executive Officer of Capital Workforce Partners, which is the workforce agency supporting our region. I do serve as a member of the CWP board and have worked very closely with Alex over the last couple of years, very impressed by their team and the good work that they do. Wanted to have a chance to bring Alex in to update the board on CWP's activities. I know many of you are new to the board and want to make sure that you're aware of our strong work relationship and how we collaborate together. So with that as a brief introduction, Alex, thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you, Matt, and thank you all for allowing me to present and update you on the work of Capital Workforce Partners. As Matt has mentioned, Capital Workforce Partners is your regional workforce development board. And what I wanted to do was to really kind of update, particularly the new elected officials that are in the region, want to update you on who we are, what we do, and the impact we have on your communities. So with that, I just wanted to start with the first slide that we have here. And as an organization, you know, we're focused on ensuring that we're meeting the demands of business, meeting the demands of our job seekers. And we measure this impact with two basic indicators. One is increasing the certification, the industry recognized certifications that individuals need so that they can compete for good jobs. And when I say good jobs, those are jobs that are normally middle skill jobs. Middle school jobs are those jobs that require more than a high school diploma, less than a baccalaureate degree. But more importantly, those are jobs that put individuals on a career path and give them wages that allow them to achieve a level of self-sufficiency. And at the same time, it's our goal to ensure that we're meeting the needs of business and industry. So key to this presentation is really trying to help you understand how we accomplish those two outcomes. Next slide. You know, it just a little background. You know, Capital Workforce Partners is your region workforce development board. As I mentioned, we serve the 37-town region. We parallel the CROG region, but it's not exact. And because it's not an exact configuration, we are required through the Federal Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act to have a group of elected officials who have signed on to our regional configuration. And that group is the Consortium of Chief Elected Officials. You know, we do get communication from us on a regular basis in terms of those meetings. So I want to give you some background in terms of why it's important for you to attend the meetings of our consortium with chief elected officials. Also, as an organization, our primary funding source and the governance structure that we are adhered to is really through the Federal Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act. This is federal legislation that was signed into law in 2015. It has the channels of funding. It provides funding for what's referred to as dislocated workers. Dislocated workers are adults who have lost their job as a result of a plant closure or workforce reduction. Adults, primarily adults who have barriers to employment, particularly literacy issues and challenges, are also eligible for our services. And young people, normally young people, opportunity youth, or at-risk young people who are at-risk in school. So those are the primary populations we serve through our federal Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act. But as an organization, we do more, and I'll cover that a little later in this presentation. Also, as an organization, last year, we served over 12,000 individuals coming into our various centers, and I'll speak to the locations of the centers. And at the same time, we're also, you know, proud to note that we're supporting over 1,400 businesses in terms of ensuring that they have the support in terms of talent acquisition, talent retention. And at the same time, as a workforce board, we also convene a number of sectoral partnerships. These are referred to as regional sector partnerships. They're in IT, healthcare, transportation, distribution, and logistics. These are the ways that we convene and connect with our business community, and I'll speak a little bit more about that later in this presentation. And then also just want to note that it's important for us as the workforce system to work in partnership with our consortium of chief elected officials from our 37 municipalities. We do have the consortium. The consortium was chaired by Mayor Aaron Stewart, and also the vice chair of that group is Mayor Jay Moran from Manchester. And they meet on a quarterly basis in partnership with the Workforce Board, and I'll speak more to that role later in this presentation. Next slide, please. And what I wanted to do, particularly for those who are new, to just kind of give you an understanding of what the kind of ecosystem looks like for the public workforce system within our state. And as I noted, you know, the funding is primarily through the Federal Department of Labor, through the Employment and Training Administration. That resource is earmarked to our governor. The governor has responsibility for determining the number of regions within a state, and within Connecticut, we have five regions, and I've noted on this chart the five regional boards. Capital Workforce Partners is one of five, but I would also note we are the largest workforce board in the state. Although we only serve 37 municipalities, we cover about a third of the state's population, and therefore a third of the need resides within our region. And then also from a governance perspective, we work in very close partnership with the Department of Labor. They are the managing organization for the resources that we have. We have compliance responsibility to the Department of Labor. And then also under Governor Lamont, it creates a governor's workforce council. This is the policy body for the state. They're the organization that is driving policy for the workforce policy for the state. And they are supported through the Office of Workforce Strategies. And again, we've worked very closely with that organization as well. So I did want to just note just the kind of configuration that we adhere to, recognizing that we are responsible for ensuring that we meet the regional needs, but at the same time, work in very close partnership, you know, with our state and ensuring that we are aligning our strategies and plans to the Governor's Workforce Council strategic plan. As I noted, you know, within the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act legislation, there are key responsibilities that our chief elected officials have that are managed through our consortium of chief elected officials. You know, primarily, and these are just some of their primary responsibilities, but key to their partnership with Capital Workforce Partners, the chief elected officials of our region appoint the members to Capital Workforce Partners Board. We do not perpetuate ourselves. The chief elected officials appoint the members of our board. Once appointed, and the board has responsibility for governing their terms, but they are not appointed by the board. Also key to the responsibilities of chief elected officials is working to ensure that we have effective memorandums of understanding with our key one-stop partners. And within the law, it requires that we have memorandums of understanding with a variety of state agencies, such as the Department of Labor, State Department of Education, Department of Rehabilitation Services, Department of Economic and Community Development, Department of Social Services, and others. So we are responsible for building that larger ecosystem within our one-stop service delivery strategy to ensure that individuals who we're serving, we're also ensuring that they're connected with all the services and supports that they need. So we're not necessarily referring them to other organizations. We invite those other organizations to be part of our AJC system. And also, as responsibility of chief elected officials, we are responsible for developing an annual or biannual Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act plan. We are in that process now. I would also note that there is a meeting of the consortium of chief elected officials scheduled for May 30th of this month, and we will be presenting the WEOA strategic plan for your consideration and approval. In addition to that, you have responsibility for ensuring the selection of our one-stop operator, as well as approving the annual budget and the annual audit for the CWP organization. So I just wanted to just acknowledge, you know, the key responsibilities that chief elected officials have within the Workforce Innovation Opportunity legislation And that role is managed through our consortium of chief elected officials. You know, and this is just another schematic. I won't labor on it given our time, but it just reflects the structure that we have, recognizing that the chief elected officials appoint the members of the board within the Capital Workforce Partners organization. We have three key standing committees. Those are the finance and audit standing committee, our executive committee, and our governance committee. I will note that we have just gone through a change in our bylaws, and we're really downsizing the number of standing committees that we have because we want to be able to respond to issues in real time. So we're promoting the notion of ad hoc groups as opposed to formal standing committees to ensure that we're responding to issues, opportunities, and challenges in a real-time basis. Slang. And as I mentioned, you know, Capital Workforce Partners, as your workforce development board, has key responsibilities. First and foremost is our responsibility to build the American Job Center system. And I call it a system because we have to build relationships with all of our key constituents to get them to connect and deliver services within our AJC. So we have that primary responsibility working in partnership with the Department of Labor. And within that center, we also manage both our Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act resources, but also as your workforce board, we also are the recipient of the state's and the manager of the state's, you know, welfare to work program. It's called the Job First Program, but it's really the welfare to work program to ensure that we're providing resources for individuals who are on assistance to get transition from assistance to employment. And then we also, in addition to managing the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act program, we also manage a variety of funding, other funding sources, and I'll speak to those later in this presentation. And then in addition to managing the AJC, as I mentioned, our core constituents are job seekers who are looking for a job, looking for a better job, or just looking for career information. And at the same time, we have a responsibility to work with our employers to ensure that we're knowledgeable of what their needs are, not just the, you know, the number of needs, the positions that they have open, but what are the necessary skills that they are looking for so that we can ensure that we're building a system that develops individuals to meet those skills so there's a seamless transition from training to employment. And then also within this, I just wanted to reflect that we also have responsibility for ensuring that special populations, those individuals who traditionally are not part of the labor force, are giving increased access and priority to the supports that we have so that we can ensure that we're enabling individuals who typically are not part of the workforce to get the resources, get the training, get the support to enable them to be successful. You know, so within that, our priority populations are returning citizens, young people, particularly opportunity youth, those individuals who are out of school, out of work, connected with DCF, individuals with disabilities, low income, low literate adults, dislocated workers, unemployed individuals, and others. But these are our primary population groups that we are funded to support. Next slide. And as I mentioned, you know, part of our responsibility is to build the AJC system, the America's Job Center system. And I would note that, you know, although it's called the America's Job Center, it's really Connecticut's connection and entry point for individuals who need access to the full array of services that I've just mentioned. And within our region, there are 20 American Job Center systems within the state, centers within the state. Seven of those centers are located in our region. And I've just provided a map here that shows where they are. And we believe they're strategically located because we want to ensure that individuals throughout our region, throughout our 37 municipalities, have access to the supports and services that we provide. So we do have centers in Hartford. We have two in Hartford, actually one, a standalone center newly opened on 60 Weston Street. And at some point soon, we will be having the ribbon cutting ceremony. And we would like to invite you to attend that ribbon cutting ceremony and get a tour. This is a state-of-the-art facility that we've just opened as of the 1st of this month. We're getting it online, and we will be having a formal ribbon cutting ceremony soon. In addition to that, we provide an access point within the Hartford Public Library. We also have a full service center at within in New Britain. We have a center in Manchester that's co-located in partnership with the Manchester Del Ed. We have a center in East Hartford that's co-located with Goodwin University. In Enfield, we're co-located with Nuntuck Community College. And in Bristol, we're co-located with Tumpsus Community College. And when I mentioned that we believe we're strategically located, because these access points allows us to immediately connect individuals to services, particularly with our college partners, it enables us to immediately connect individuals to the certificate, the industry recognized credential training programs that our community colleges provide, so we can connect them to training and then support their transition into employment. You know, the next slide here just kind of speaks to, and I would note that as coming out of the pandemic, the good news, if there's such a thing as good news resulting from the pandemic, but what it did is by shutting down our centers because we were no longer able to support walk-in traffic, and our centers prior to the pandemic were solely based on center-based services. As a result of the pandemic, we were able to create virtual tools so that individuals now can receive the full array of supports and services that we provide virtually. You know, so you can visit our centers physically. We welcome individuals to come into our centers, but also individuals can connect with us virtually through our call center, through our live chat. And also in partnership with the Office of Workforce Strategies, we've launched a Career Connect statewide portal. This is an intake portal where individuals can enroll themselves. They can enroll in the portal. They can also register with the state's job bank. The CT Hires job bank can also do some pre-assessments and really connect with us in a way where we can support them virtually as well as physically. So just wanted to note that we have no wrong doorway of individuals getting entry into our services. Next slide. You know, what I wanted to just take a minute, you know, I've spoken about the supports that we provide, but I just want to kind of give you just a quick, you know, background in terms of, you know, an environmental scan. You know, and as I see, you know, currently we have opportunity. As we all know, employers are desperate for workers. Everywhere you go, you're seeing help wanted sign. You know, there are over 81,000 unfilled jobs within our state. That's good news. You know, there's many opportunities for us to train and connect the individuals that we support to, you know, to employment opportunities. We also have the commitment of business and industry. And as I mentioned, we're working with over 1,000 companies who are working diligently with us to help us build strategies, pathways, so that we're moving individuals from unemployment to employment. And then our governor, you know, through the Career Connects Initiative, has also made a significant financial investment. Through the Career Connects Initiative, our governor has committed $110 million to provide supports to individuals. Thus far, we have trained an additional 8,000 people statewide. You know, so the good news is that there's many jobs, there's resources available. So that's where we are in terms of the opportunity. The next slide speaks to the challenge that we're working with as an organization and really as a workforce system. As I mentioned on the previous slide, we have 81,000 job openings in this state. This slide speaks to the fact that of those 81,000 job openings, we only have around 72,000 individuals competing for those 81,000 jobs. And that's why there's help wanted signs all over the place, because as we are hearing, there's just not enough qualified labor in order to meet the demands of companies, particularly those who are in the position to grow and expand their work. You know, and the challenges, as I note on this slide, is there are untapped populations. There are over 200,000 individuals within the state who are low literate, who aren't able to necessarily compete for these middle-skilled jobs because they have literacy challenges. You know, so how are we providing the kinds of supports to those individuals who have those literacy challenges? And then at the same time, and I know a lot of us have heard the information from the Delia report, bless you, where there's over 119,000 young people who are disconnected, and disengaged. If we're able to salvage a portion of that population, we'll be able to create a labor supply where individuals will have opportunities to meet their needs. So I just wanted to illustrate on those two slides what our opportunities are and what the challenges that there are before us in terms of really building pathways for that untapped population to get the necessary supports and resources so that they're able to transition themselves into the labor market and effectively compete for employment. Just on this slide, just wanted to speak to, we have a variety of training programs and a variety of funding sources. And as I mentioned, we're governed primarily through the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, but we also, through the fact that we're also competing for other grant opportunities, have bought in another wealth of other grants. So a lot of these are federal discretionary grants that we've had access. And in addition, we manage our Summer Youth Employment Learning Program. I'm happy to note that as of now, the governor did increase the funding for the Summer Youth Employment Learning Program from $5 million to $10 million. So it's going to enable us to provide more summer jobs to individuals. And this is a regional program. And in addition to that, we were fortunate that through some legislative efforts, our region was also earmarked another $500,000 to support summer jobs. So we're in a good place to provide meaningful job opportunities to our young people. And I'll just quickly move through the rest of these slides. As I mentioned, you know, we support individuals who have barriers. So I just wanted to provide this information. I assume members have copies of this presentation or can get copies of it. You know, so I wanted to give you more information than I'm going to have the time to review this afternoon, but really just give you a base for information. We're happy to be able to reach out to you, you know, meet with you. We want to be able to work with all of our communities, all of our community stakeholders. Next slide. And as I mentioned, we engage businesses through our sectorial partnerships. And we have four that we're supporting in IT and healthcare and transportation, distribution, logistics, and in advanced manufacturing. Each of those sector partnerships was looking at the notion of skills-based hiring. And it's critically important when we're looking at what are the skills that individuals need to have, not necessarily the educational background. And in particular, we're excited at the work we're doing with our employer partners around IT, where in IT, typically you needed to have a baccalaureate degree as a necessary required prerequisite. Now employers are looking at what are those essential skills that individuals need to have so that they can start their work journey and at the same time continue their educational development process while they're working. So we're doing a lot to build those talent pipelines, looking at quality jobs, and how we're promoting the value of the industries and the various sectors. Next slide. And now just kind of quickly scroll through a couple of these. This is just a slide of our of the partners, and we work with a wealth of partners and organizations. And also, you know, as I've mentioned, you know, we have the luxury of having resources available. And I really just want you as chief elected officials to know that we're constantly recruiting for individuals, for training programs in our key sectors. You know, so here we're one of our posters where we're currently recruiting for individuals to enroll in the manufacturing programs that we're operating through the community college. You know, we're also have resources provide individuals for training in healthcare. There's a variety of training opportunities and positions within healthcare that we're training for. So I invite you to circulate this information to your constituents and encourage them to apply to us through the portal, through the virtual, or come into our center to make themselves available for our services. Also, transportation, distribution, logistics, you know, where we have, you know, targeted resources to train individuals, particularly for truck drivers. As we know, there's a considerable need for truck drivers, CDLAs. So we're also in position of providing training and support to individuals who want to pursue careers in the truck driving industry. And I'll skip this last slide because I do want to end on this note here. As an organization, you know, we have an annual meeting. Our annual meeting is scheduled for June 21st at the Marriott Arkham. And it's not a business meeting per se. The annual meeting of our board is really the opportunity that we take to really uplift, give voice to the customers that we serve, particularly those who have gone through life's challenges and achieved success and partnerships through the supports and services that we provide. You know, so at our annual meeting, you'll hear some of the stories from some of the adult job seekers, some of our returning citizens who have gone through our programs and are moved from unemployment to employment, to positions where they now are providing self-sufficiency for themselves. You'll hear stories of our young people who are out of school, out of work, and now are gainfully. So these are the success stories that we're going to uplift and promote within our annual meeting. At the same time, we're also going to recognize the unique partnerships that we have with employers. And it's really going to be an opportunity for you to really see the value and the impact of the support and services that we provide. So I want to encourage you to consider attending our annual meeting. It's a free buffet breakfast. And at the same time, I think it's going to be an opportunity for you to really feel the value of the work that Capital Workforce Partners does. So with that, you know, this last slide is, you know, to contact us, but I also invite you to contact me directly if you want additional information, if you want to access the services we provide. You know, we're here to support, you know, you as chief elected officials, particularly, you know, the needs that you have to ensure that the residents of your community have access to the training programs that we provide, developing the skills to enable them to be successful. So with that, I know I kind of went through this quickly, but I know you have a very lengthy agenda. So again, you know, thank you for this opportunity to update you on the work of Capital Workforce Partners. And I look forward to continuing to have this conversation and working with you in the future. So thank you all, and thank you, Matt.
Thank you so much, Alex, for that very comprehensive overview. And I can say from personal experience, the annual meeting, it's a really, really powerful to hear the stories of folks who may have gone through some hard times and now through CWP's resources have been able to find gainful employment. So I would encourage as many of you who are available to attend that meeting on the 21st to please do so. So turning it over to our chair, Madam Chair, Lori, any questions you and others may have for Alex?
Open it up for anybody's questions.
Yeah, this is Al Schwab out of Bloomfield. Good afternoon, team. And thank you, Alex, for that very insightful presentation. You had mentioned that the slide deck would be available. I just wanted to see how we can get our hands on that.
Yep, I have somebody dropping it in the chat right now, and then I'm going to email it to the policy board members and alternates. And I can post it online too.
Thank you.
Thank you, Alvin.
That's great. Does anybody else have any questions? If not, we'll move to action.
I have one. This is Lisa Murata from the town of Rocky Hill. You had mentioned some collaborations and partnerships with the community colleges. I happen to work part-time at Southern, and I'm wondering if in the School of Business, and we've launched a lot of programs recently to support people in the community for in a variety of areas that you've suggested. And I'm wondering, do you have relationships with the public universities as well?
Yes, we do. We are continuing to build, but yes, we are building relations with the higher ed as well. Yes.
Anybody else have any questions before we move on?
Certainly a pressing issue. I mean, I know all the towns at the municipal level struggle to gain staff too, mm-hmm. and that's certainly a problem throughout the economy. So the more people we can gainfully employ, the better off we're all going to be. So I applaud your efforts.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll ask one more time if there's any other questions. If not, we'll move on to action items. Number 7, Approval of proposed FYI 2024-2025 budget proposed. Matt?
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. So just before I proceed with the budget presentation, a reminder for those of you who may have joined on a few minutes late, we are taking care of business items first. We've got a heavy agenda today, so we're going to take care of our business items, and then we will move on to staff reports and our legislative update. We will save that for the end. We're probably going to need closer to 1:30 today, probably going to need closer to 90 minutes of your time. If we do lose a quorum, we will not be able to vote on our business items, and we'll have to carry those over to our June meeting. And we do have two board members in the room here with us today. We've got Lisa Thomas, the council chair in Coventry, and Eric Anderson, the town administrator from the town of Andover. So moving on to present PROG's budget, I'm going to take the lead. There are a couple of slides at the end that Pauline Yoder will handle. And like any budget that you put together at your level, the local level, it's certainly a team effort. And Pauline is the chief architect, but all of our directors work really hard on putting the budget together, as do other members of the CROG team. Next slide, please. So CROG's budget is just a little bit different from your municipal budget if this is your first time going through this with us. Our budget is much smaller than yours, and we do not have a separate capital fund or capital improvement program. Pretty much everything flows through our operating budget. We also, you will recall, we don't have taxing authority, so our revenues are somewhat different. Our budget highlights, our budget is balanced. It's designed to maintain all of our current services and programs and to support our strategic priorities. The budget does maintain our current due structure, which is good news for all of our towns. Again, as a refresher, that's a $3,000 base for every community, as well as a little under 69 cents per capita. If you do see some modest changes in your dues, that's accountable to population shifts, but the due structure remains the same. Next slide, please. So moving on, the budget is designed, as I said a moment or two ago, to support CROG's strategic priorities. Those priorities we've set out in our strategic playbook. So designed to support our work in helping you secure federal infrastructure funding under Safe Streets for All and similar programs. Budget's designed to promote economic vitality in our new role as the region's economic development district. Our regional housing strategy, that's going to be a very important project that we're about to embark upon. Also designed to facilitate our work in the area of regional environmental services, waste management, and stormwater management. Other important initiatives include road safety, complete streets, and bike pedestrian projects. We've been engaged in that work for many years now, as you know, supporting our efforts in public transit and to promote transit-oriented development across the region. And last but certainly not least, promoting our work in shared services, and somewhat related to the presentation we just had from Mr. Johnson, workforce development. In recent years, CROG has been very focused on the workforce needs for our member towns. Before I do go further, I should have said this at the beginning. The executive committee, CROG's executive committee, did vote in favor of the proposed budget and supports its endorsement by the full policy board. Next slide, please. So first, a quick look at the current fiscal year. And as you can see, our revenues and expenditures do match up at approximately $7.6 million. Those of you with a sharp eye will note that this is somewhat lower than the adopted budget, which was approximately $9.2 million. And that is just due to the fact of staff vacancies we had how we the timing of completed projects, funding sources, et cetera. And periodically, or actually in many years, if not most years, we do not expend the full adopted budget for those reasons. Next slide, please. So next slide, please. Now let's look at the proposed budget for the fiscal year ahead. And you can see on the revenue side, we're approximately $10 million. And on the expenditure, approximately $10 million. On the expenditure side, somewhat lower at approximately $9.7 million. Next slide, please. This is a quick snapshot of our revenues and expenditures. So again, our budget is different from your local budgets in many ways. The bulk of our revenues come from the federal government. These are federal monies, primarily from FHWA in the area of transportation planning, comprises 61% of our operating revenues for next year. The next largest funding source comes from the state, primarily in the form of the regional services grant at 28%. And local dues, interestingly, make up less than 10% of our operating revenues. And that is common in recent years. And then we've got our smaller category, our other category at 3%. Now looking at the expenditure side, you will see the most of the largest category, is in the area of contractual, 46%. Those are the consultants and other folks we utilize to assist us with our projects. Next highest category is for salary for our staff team here. Similarly, we've got our fringe and indirect expenditures, and then the smallest category, a number of direct expenditures that we have in our other category. Moving on, next slide, please. So our budget, we break it up into six primary categories. I will touch on each one very quickly. Next slide, please. First, in the area of regional planning and development, and that department, as you know, is headed by Caitlin Palmer. And the revenue, this proposed budget is approximately $1.6 million for next year. The bulk of the revenue coming from federal government, followed by state government. And you see on the expenditure side, the bulk of the planned expenditures are for our brownfield program, followed by personnel. And these are the folks that work in regional planning, economic development, brownfields, as I mentioned, and various related projects and initiatives. Next slide, please. Next, I want to touch on transportation planning. This is our largest single department in terms of funding and staff. And these folks, this department is headed by Rob Eloise. They support the region's Metropolitan Planning Organization, as well as the very popular Local Transportation Capital Improvement Program and related studies and projects. On the revenue side, you see here on the left-hand side, the bulk of our revenues coming from the federal government, followed by state government. The bulk of the expenditures are for personnel, followed by costs related to our projects and studies, the consultants we hire, for example. So that's transportation plan. Next slide, please. Next area I wanted to touch on is public safety and homeland security. This department is headed by Cheryl Assis. This department works very closely with DEMIS Region 3. Out of all nine COGs in the state, we have the closest working relationship with DEMIS. We support them very, very closely in their work. We also support regional and local health districts across our region. On the revenue side, you see the bulk of the funding here coming from the federal government, just about all of it. On the expenditure side, the two highest categories are those grant projects we administer to support regional and local health departments, followed by those homeland security projects. Next slide, please. Regional services and council administration. This component of the budget falls under Pauline Yoder, our chief operating officer. This work supports our shared services, to some extent, public safety, and regional planning and transportation planning as well. It's kind of a combination of things, if you will. On the revenue side, the bulk of the revenues here are coming from the state government in the form of that regional services grant. Local dues also make up an important part of this component of the budget. On the expenditure side, you will see the bulk of the spending is for personnel. That's regional services and council administration. Municipal services, also headed by Pauline Yoder. This supports our purchasing council, IT shared services, Crumbling Foundation's testing program, and a variety of related initiatives. The bulk of the funding here is coming from state government, followed by the federal government. The bulk of the spending is for grants that we administer, followed by personnel. Next slide, please. So that completes our quick review of the six major categories for our budget. We're going to wrap it up with staffing. So our proposed staffing for the coming fiscal year on an FTE count is a little under 32 FTE. You can see Pauline is very, very precise in her calculations here. In terms of the number of folks sitting here at Broad, we will have 34. That does include a couple of vacancies. And we do also rely on 3 part-time contractors in public safety and homeland security. Next slide, please. So we're now going to turn to Ms. Yoder. Pauline's going to talk a little bit about our fund balance and one additional slide. And then we will take any questions you might have and then hopefully a resolution.
I will note that the preciseness is Excel, not myself. The fund balance is basically follows generally our department structure. The item I think of most interest to the members would probably be the regional fund. That's the fund that we use for match, as well as any regional projects that don't have outside funding. I will note that of the 1.9 million, some of that money has been committed to either potential grants or grants that we have received. So that's on that, and we can go to the next slide. And then this is sort of the exercise we do every year of a 5-year projection in terms of worst case, likely best case scenario. There's always a negative dip in the future years because I'm pessimistic. But I will also note that we have in the worst case scenario, we would have time to do conduct any mitigation measures so that it's not likely to happen. So that would be
great.
And then I think the last is questions and answers before.
Thank you so much, Pauline. So that's our budget presentation. Madam Chair, again, the Executive Committee did vote in favor of the budget and recommends its approval by the full policy board.
Anybody have any questions?
I'll just chime in real quick, and I just want to thank Matt and Pauline and the whole team for, obviously, as we all know, on the municipal level, putting a budget together is a long process with a lot of input from all staff, and appreciate the work that was put into it. Serve on the executive committee and was part of the vote to recommend adoption and fully support it. If there's any other questions, I'll let people talk about it and then happy to make a motion or second to move adoption.
Thanks, Steve. It's Mark Nelson in Simsbury. So new to the job in January, but just a quick question on that special fund balance, the 1.9 million. Could you just give me, thanks for putting that slide up. Can you just give me maybe the last 3 years moving, or did I miss that? So put that in perspective as to where we were a year or two ago, and has it been declining or holding steady?
Um, It has been either increasing or holding steady. I would say that depending on the different projects and the match that it's used for, but it's a year or two ago, it was at 1.7, 1.8, just off the top of my head. And we've used it a little, but we've also, every year we put in we budget to put in $100,000 into it. So,
good. Well, thanks for that. It looks like a really good budget. I want to thank everybody that put this together. I see it's in the chat, too. I hope it's in the chat so we can grab this. But thanks, everybody. Good job.
Thank you, Mark.
Okay, anybody else? If not, do we have a motion?
So moved.
Second, Mark and Simsbury.
Okay. Any other discussion? If not, all in favor?
Aye.
Motion passes, from what I can figure. Moving on to number 8, resolution authorizing transportation committee to act as policy board. Mr. John Coleman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is the annual resolution that both the transportation committee and the policy board adopt. So that the Transportation Committee can act on behalf of the Policy Board in the month of July when the Policy Board is not meeting. In prior years, it's been for 2 months. This year, we're only going to be doing it for 1 month since you are meeting in June. The Transportation Committee passed a companion resolution on Monday, recommends the same to the Policy Board, and I would so move.
Second.
Okay, second, Peter. Any other discussion or anything? If not, all in favor?
Aye.
Great. Thank you. Motion passes. Moving on to 9, resolution to accept Regional Waste Authority RWA grant of $570,000 from DEEP. Robin Nichols?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. This is a resolution asking that the CROG Policy Board authorize CROG's Executive Director, Matt Hart, to accept a grant from the state of Connecticut's DEEP for the amount of $570,000 for our regional waste authority, which many of you are aware, we have the Central Connecticut Solid Waste Authority in our region, representing many of our municipalities.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you, John.
Second.
Thank you.
Thomas.
Is there any discussion on this? If not, all in favor?
Aye.
Any nays? Opposed? Motion passes. Moving on to number 10, resolution authorizing acceptance of U.S. Department of Transportation, Federal Highway Administration, HWA electric vehicle charger reliability and accessibility accelerator EVC-RAA grant proposed. Elizabeth?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. This is a resolution that would authorize Matt as executive director to accept a grant from FHWA in the amount of $684,800 for the repair of an inoperable charging station at the Cumberland Farms in West Hartford.
Okay, does anybody have any questions? Ben?
I'd move the resolution. Jason from East Windsor.
Okay. Can I have a second, please?
Second, John Coleman.
Okay. Any discussion? If not, all in favor?
Aye.
Anybody opposed? Motion passes.
Madam Chair, we did get a question in the room from Ms. Thomas, which we could probably handle quickly.
Yeah, I want to clarify. So it's a $684,800 grant to fix one charging station.
So it'll be a 4-port charging station, but it is a single location.
They can be costly.
They are. And it upgrades it to a DC, a fast charging station, too. Those are the more
but it's actually for individual places to plug in.
Correct.
Oh, four. Yes, it is. Four ports.
Thank you, Lisa. Back to you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Moving on to number 11, resolution to accept a climate resilient and fund grant of $250,000 for CROG Regional Stormwater Authority, a feasibility study.
Great, thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, yeah, so this resolution would allow Matt to approve or accept the climate resilience grant fund that would allow us to explore the feasibility of a regional stormwater utility, and if found to be successful and feasible, this would help our towns potentially create a dedicated source of funding to help our municipalities finance and maintain stormwater infrastructure. Yes,
okay. Did we have a second on, or anybody want to make a motion?
So moved.
Okay.
Second, Peter Souza.
Thank you, Peter. All in favor?
Aye.
Anybody oppose? If not, motion passes. Moving on to Metropolitan Planning Organizational Items. Number 12, TIP amendments. Mr. Coleman?
Madam Chair, there are four TIP amendments. They were reviewed and approved by the Transportation Committee in its meeting on Monday. One is for improvements at Curtis Park. Two and three are for various traffic control upgrades around District 2 and District 4. And number four is for upgrades to electric charging stations in West Hartford. Again, the Transportation Committee reviewed and unanimously endorsed all four of them, recommended same to the Policy Board as acting as the MPO, and I would so move.
Do I have a second?
Second, Mark and Simsbury.
Thank you, Mark. Any discussion? If not, all in favor?
Aye.
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 Okay, anybody oppose? Motion passes. Moving on to 13, resolution of endorsement of Route 20 transportation and land use study, Windsor Locks, Mr. Coleman.
Again, this is one of the significant corridor studies and land use studies that are undertaken by CROG on behalf of and with the host community, in this case, Windsor Locks. This has been endorsed by the Windsor Locks community and has been approved by the Transportation Committee, and recommend same to the Policy Board acting as the MPO. And I would so move, and if there are any specific questions, I would defer to staff.
Second.
Okay. Any discussion? If not, all in favor?
Aye.
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 Anybody oppose? If not, motion passes. Moving on to resolution endorsement of the FFY 2025-2028 Transportation Improvement Program, TIP. Mr. Coleman.
Again, thank you, Madam Chair. This is the both annual and three-year Transportation Improvement Program that is prepared by the State of Connecticut Department of Transportation to include all of the programs that we have endorsed at the regional level. Transportation Committee has reviewed and endorsed and so recommends to the Policy Board, and I would so move.
Is there a second?
Second, Steve Stefano.
Thank you, Steve. Any more discussion? If not, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Anybody oppose? Not, motion passes. Moving on to number 15. I'm trying to get through this for people who want to leave. Resolution for conformity with the Clean Air Act Ozone. Mr. Coleman.
This is an annual certification process we have to go through on behalf of the Federal Highway Transportation getting our funding. We are confirming that we are conforming with the Clean Air Act, which according to all the data that we've been provided, we are. And the Transportation Committee passed a similar resolution at its meeting on Monday. Recommend same to the Policy Board, and I would so move.
Second, thank Steve Stefano.
Thank you, Steve. Is there any discussion or questions on this number 15 resolution? If not, all in favor?
Aye.
Anybody opposed? Motion passes. Moving on to number 16, resolution, annual urban planting certification. Mr. Coleman.
Finally, thank you, Madam Chair. Last but not least, we are self-certifying that we are doing all things right in terms of our urban planning, which I believe we are and which the Transportation Committee believes it is. And so it passed a similar resolution at its meeting on Monday. Recommend same to the Policy Board, and I would so move.
Okay, could I have a second?
Second, Lisa Thomas.
Thank you, Lisa. Is there any more discussion on this or questions? If not, all in favor?
Aye.
Any nays? If not, all motion passes. Moving on to number 4, staff reports. Matt.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thank you all for hanging on to complete our business items. We'll now move through our staff reports and wrap up with our legislative update. So, very excited to be holding our 50th annual meeting on June 5th. And this year we're gonna be at Building 4 in Manchester. And the meeting will run from 2 to 5 p.m. And Anthony, the state's chief marketing officer, who many of you may have heard previously, he's a dynamic speaker. He's gonna be our guest speaker this year. So really looking forward to having a great group of proud folks joining Mayor Moran and Steve Stefano and the rest of the team here in Manchester. Moving on, want to congratulate Mayor Stewart and the City of New Britain on the opening of their new public works facility. Rob Elwies and I had a chance to attend this a couple weeks back. And it's actually our largest Easy IQC project to date. Really excited about that. The Easy IQC component was about $13.6 million. And then the city funded some additional elements. It was about a $20 million project overall. Any of you who might be contemplating a new public works facility, I would highly recommend this as a model. Moving on, CCM's Deputy Director Ron Thomas and I will be co-chairing a work group at the Advisory Committee on Intergovernmental Relations, task force tasked with looking at municipal workforce development needs. Recall I talked about that in the budget presentation. I know Steve Stefano will be joining us, and we'll be looking for volunteers from across the region. Next item, we're gonna hold our next policy board meeting at 12 noon on June 26th. We're gonna be reviewing the Greater Hartford Mobility Study. I'll give you a status update on our strategic playbook. And that will be our last meeting before the summer break, as the policy board does not meet in July and August. Next slide, please. Moving on to an update on the bipartisan infrastructure law. I want to thank Elizabeth Sanderson for her continued great work. And with her assistance and from others and from the good work of many folks in our member towns, thus far we've secured 20 discretionary grants under the bipartisan infrastructure law, totaling over $56 million in federal funding. We're roughly halfway through that program. Let's see if we can double this number, maybe even higher, by the end of that 5-year period. A couple of additional items. The U.S. Department of Transportation is now accepting applications under the very popular Safe Streets and Roads for All. That's been the most popular initiative in our region to date. This program is designed to fund projects to prevent deaths and serious injuries on our roadways. The DOT is also accepting applications on a rolling basis to its bridge investment program, but the bridges and the culverts must be listed on the National Bridge Inventory. Just wanted to flag that one for you as well. Moving on, the area of administration and municipal services under Pauline Yoder, our purchasing council, which actually has 134 members, 134 out of 169 towns, we are accepting new members for our energy consortium. And we had a really good presentation on that at Municipal Services Committee earlier this week. If you're not a member and would like to join, would direct you to Kim Bona on our team. Our Human Services Coordinating Council, which is comprised of human services professionals from across our region, is scheduled to meet virtually on June 18th. Robin Nichols from our team is the convener, the facilitator. This quarter, they're going to be looking at housing unaffordability and insecurity in our region. Our staff continues to develop our regional data portal, which incorporates interactive mapping, data downloads, project visualization for your team and for the public. Would encourage you to check it out if you haven't in the recent past. In the area of transportation planning, headed by Rob Alois, with support from Kara Radzins and others. So our staff team continues to coordinate with Federal Highway and the City of New Britain to update our regional transportation safety plan, funded by the SS Beret grant we received here at CROG. We also have a Vision Zero Council that's meeting and assisting with that project. A couple of upcoming studies we're excited to announce. We did issue an RFQ, for a regional bicycle and pedestrian priority network plan. We're excited about that, how we can build out that network across our region. And we do anticipate issuing a request for qualifications by the end of this month for a regional warehousing land use and traffic study. Moving on to public safety, again, this area is headed by Cheryl Cease. Really looking forward to our FEMA 402 class on the NIMS system for senior officials, chief elected officials, and chief executives. This is really targeted at all of you. Maybe you are new to your role as a town manager or new to your role as a mayor. Looking forward to this class that we're going to hold this on May 24th from 9 to 12:30. Our Region 3 Cybersecurity Task Force continues to meet. This is a really neat forum where we have IT professionals as well as emergency management and public safety folks working together to address this important issue. Next slide, please. And then last but certainly not least, in the area of regional planning and development, Caitlin Palmer and the members of her team, very excited to announce, and she'll be with us next month, that we have hired CROG's first ever economic development coordinator. So we're looking forward to welcoming Kim Bishop, who is an alum of the Metro Hartford Alliance, to our team on May 28th. As we talked about in our 11 o'clock session on the POCD, we are developing an RFQ for our regional housing strategy. It's going to be a big, big project for CROG. Excited about that. We'll be releasing that in the next month or so. We did issue an RFP for a new regional micro-mobility services. We issued that at the end of April. Hartford and New Britain from our region, as well as the City of New Haven from outside of our region, are very active participants in this, and we are looking, all CROG member towns are welcome to participate in this initiative. And then lastly, we are working with the State Department of Housing to identify communities that are interested in receiving technical assistance from the Department of Housing to advance their affordable housing plans. And Madam Chair, with your indulgence, I'd like to call on Ben Lovejoy from the DOH. He is a COG alum himself, to just talk a little bit about this program. Ben, welcome.
Thank you, Matt, and thank you to the chair for the opportunity to speak. I'll keep this short and sweet because I know
I'll have a lot on the table. Again, thank you for mentioning just the brief overview of the program, Matt, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak before this board. Some of you may know me, my name is Ben Lovejoy, and I'm a project manager for the Department of Housing. I just got brought on to manage a brand new municipal affordable housing technical assistance program that the Department of Housing launched in March of 2024. It'll run through the February of 2027, and my hopes are to prove that this is a program that should be a permanent fixture at the agency. Essentially, a little background. Earlier this year, the commissioner recognized that many of our municipalities across the state are struggling to make progress on the recommendations and goals and their locally adopted affordable housing plans. And they created she created this program at the agency in hopes that we can find a way to assist in the process. I was hired as the project manager for this program and essentially told to get out there and help out municipalities that are requesting my assistance. The assistance I'll provide will look different in every municipality because each one of you are unique. It may be staff trainings, facilitated workshops, research on a specific topic such as inclusionary zoning or creating a housing trust fund. While in other municipalities, it may look like coordinating resources and connecting the town with a developer for future, with potential for funding opportunities. If you guys, if your respective municipality has a parcel that is like sort of been identified and wants to move forward. Either way, if you believe that your municipality would benefit from participating in this free program, please feel free to contact me to set up this preliminary meeting. It should be mentioned that whenever possible and where it's appropriate, I'll be working with CROG so that our collective efforts, make progress on regional goals as well. So get used to seeing me at the various meetings. There's additional information. I want to thank the staff at CROG for putting my announcement and a flyer on the CROG website under their housing programming. And then I can put my contact information in the chat. Again, I appreciate you giving me an opportunity to speak. And if any municipalities are interested in setting up a preliminary meeting, please feel free to just email me or call me on my work cell. And I can hopefully get in there and start the process. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you very much, Ben. We appreciate you being here and hanging in there. That completes Absolutely. Our staff report, Madam Chair. Happy to take any questions that you or other members may have, and then we can wrap up with our legislative update.
Matt, do you think it would be possible to set up a tour through New Britain's new DPW facility?
I imagine our distinguished chair would love to do that. I'll be happy to reach out to her and set that up.
Okay, thank you. Does anybody have anything else? If not, we'll move on to number four, legislative updates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Matt Hart here again. I'm going to lead off and talk about some legislative issues that are very important to CROG. And then I'm going to turn to Chris Smith from Rome Smith Kowalski, who ably represents us, to talk a little bit about more globally in terms of what transpired this session, as well as his thoughts about the potential for a special session to address some remaining items. I do want to acknowledge Jason Bauza, first selectman from the town of East Windsor, who serves as the chair of our ad hoc legislative committee, as well as all of the CROG policy board members who serve on our legislative committee. They help put our legislative agenda together. They help us track it throughout the session and lend testimony where appropriate. So, moving on to CROG's legislative priorities, you may have seen it. If you haven't had a chance to look at it yet, I would encourage you to do so. I did publish an article, just a bit of a recap from the session. John Harkins from the RSK team assisted me with this, as did Aaliyah Miller from our CROG team. I think overall we fared pretty well in terms of what we were able to accomplish this session. And I'll start off by talking about service sharing. Many of you will recall the governor's bill on service sharing, House Bill 5056, which CROG championed very strongly. And we did hold a press conference in Wethersfield Town Hall with the governor to highlight it. And the bill, it did go through a couple of changes over the course of the session, but ultimately much of it was incorporated within the state's bond bill. And I think the legislation that was approved, which is designed really to eliminate barriers that might be created under local charters and town ordinances, barriers to service sharing, could enable us to do some really good things. We've talked about, for example, the potential of establishing a regional fair rent commission. We've talked about some of the challenges to implementing our regional performance incentive program grants, challenges created by maybe conflicting provisions under local charters or local ordinances. This legislation will help us to get through those things. And we're going to continue that conversation at the Municipal Services Committee, chaired by Peter Souza, and talk about how we can utilize this legislation to promote service sharing here in our region. Those are towns sharing services with school districts, as well as additional services we might be able to provide here at CROC. So I think that is the most significant element for us in terms of what we were able to accomplish this past session. I'll more briefly touch on some other things. Medicare reimbursement rates for ambulance service. I know Lisa Thomas reached out to me earlier with some good questions on that, and Chris Smith is researching it, and we'll be able to follow up with you soon on that, Lisa. But it does look like we've been able to gain a little bit of relief here. Recall, our goal was to increase the state reimbursement to the federal level. Now, while we don't look, we're not sure we're going to be able to get to that exact target, we should see some additional relief and reimbursement, some improved reimbursement over the recent year. So we'll follow up in response to Lisa's question and provide more specific information on Medicaid reimbursement rates for ambulance services. In the area of waste management, the state did extend the deadline for OPM to give recommendations to a couple of key legislative committees regarding the feasibility of creating a new solid waste related, I apologize for the lengthy title here, quasi-public state agency. So we're going to track that. We're going to track that in conjunction with our work on that regional waste management grant. Good news for our towns and small towns across the state. The Small Town Economic Assistance Program are steep. So legislation this year does increase from $500,000 to $1 million, maximum grant amount that you could receive in any given fiscal year. So that's certainly good news. And with respect to housing reform, we know that this has been a hotly debated subject in recent years. There was a multifaceted bill that was approved this session that incorporates recommendations from the Majority Leader's Housing Roundtable. It'll serve to promote the development of affordable housing more generally. Among other things, it would require municipalities to allow developers to convert vacant nursing homes into multifamily housing. Also permits our municipalities to regulate short-term rentals and requires landlords to provide tenants with a minimum of 45 days notice of planned rent increases. There's some other important changes under that bill as well. In the area of solar siting was an important component of CROG's legislative agenda this past year as well, important to East Windsor, Manchester, Windsor, and many others. We were able to accomplish a few things this past session. For example, the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, DEEP, will be studying the feasibility of a uniform capacity tax for solar systems. The legislation also introduces a definition for a solar canopy and allows, not requires, now allows municipalities to amend local zoning to establish a more simplified approval process for applications and to deny or approve those applications within 6 months after an application is filed. And just a couple of additional items I want to touch on before I turn things over to Chris. This is important for our eastern towns. There's a bill, Senate Bill 224, that does require municipal assessors to notify owners of residential buildings that have been reassessed due to defective concrete foundations of an upcoming reval cycle. And then OPM had a bill, House Bill 5273, that will provide various technical changes that are important to the department. And importantly for us, also revises the Regional Performance Incentive Program somewhat to make it easier for us to administer. And hopefully will lead to additional submittals under that popular grant program. And I will close before I turn things over to Chris by thanking the town of Glastonbury, Jonathan Louise, the town manager in particular. They spearheaded this bill, Senate Bill 226. This is a bit of a technical fix, if you will. Those municipalities who do have an ordinance on the books that requires sealed bidding, it does increase the threshold for sealed bidding from $25,000 to $50,000. So I want to thank the town of Glastonbury for their efforts there. I know that was a lot, Madam Chair, but overall, I think we fared well with respect to Frog's legislative agenda. I'd now like to turn briefly to Chris to give us more of a global outlook, if you will, talk about the potential for a special session. Then we can take any questions you might have. Chris, welcome.
Thank you very much, Matt. And John Harkin sends his regrets. I know he spent a considerable amount of time working on behalf of CROG in the LOB in the Capitol this session. He did have an immovable conflict, but my hope is that I can aptly pinch hit for him. He and I did work together on a number of these issues. And I think, Matt, that was a great summary of a lot of the key things that passed. This session was, I think every legislative session, I think, is unique and strange in its own way. And I think this particular 2024 legislative session was unique in the sense that, number one, there was so few bills, comparatively speaking, that made it through both chambers. Neither chamber was in nearly the number of hours that they are normally in a budget revision session, even numbered year. I don't think the House ever went in really past midnight at all this session. The Senate only went past midnight once or twice. And the number of bills that they put out was significantly less than they normally do. On behalf of CROG, we tracked 128 different pieces of legislation. Not all of those were of direct interest, but we do track a lot of them to make sure that we're staying on top of any amendments or things that change and in different bills that might be of interest to us. Of those, 18 passed. And I think a number of the ones that Matt just covered are encapsulated within those 18 that did pass. I do think that what is likely to come up again next year, things that did not happen. I think there's certainly going to be more discussion on housing issues and TOD, solid waste, artificial intelligence, which I think has broad implications for just about every sector, including municipal governments, and potentially that did not make it across the finish line this year, but will certainly be coming back. Education. I know we haven't talked much about that, but I think some of the pain points that municipalities face too is, you know, some of the special education costs and the state's lack of fully funding that. I think there is movement on that front that we can be looking forward to next year. With respect to the immediate future, there is I would say more likely than not going to be a special session, probably on or around the 24th of June, which coincides with the annual veto override session. They rarely do veto overrides, but they are required to convene to consider those. And it looks like they might be putting together a package for a special session on that date. That was new news over the last couple of days, still trying to figure out what they are going to tackle. I think at a minimum, they are looking at what I understand to be House Bill 5172 on the motor vehicle taxation issue. Apparently there was some clarifications that need to take place on that, the details of which are still being worked out. So as we stand here now on Wednesday, the 22nd, I don't have clarity on exactly what they're looking at, but we should have that within the next several days. I know the chiefs of staff for both the House and the Senate, Democratic leadership are meeting today to talk about what that may look like. What we always worry about when they do a special session is what else is included. And so we'll be monitoring that over the next several days as that becomes more clear. But do expect that if they are to do one, we're probably about a month out from when they would convene. I do want to go back to the Medicaid ambulance issue. Matt, I think you gave a good update on that, but I do want to be a little bit of a wet blanket on that one because the language that's included is, quote, within available appropriations. That type of language and statute is always a little bit of a get out of jail free card for implementing it, because if they don't have the money to do it, then they won't do it. And this is a strange year in the sense that they did not do a conventional budget adjustment like they normally do. There was no revenue changes. There were no general fund changes. And Medicaid is one of the largest line items that we have in the state of Connecticut. That was not modified. I did speak with DSS this morning, and they too are figuring out how that's going to be implemented and what that exactly means. And if they don't have appropriations to cover it, it may not be that full amount. And so they're currently looking into that. I spoke to them about 11 o'clock this morning. I should have some feedback from them over the coming days. So I did want to just clarify that point. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions you all might have. I think there's some more activity that's going to be taking place over the next month with respect to the special session. After that, whether or not that takes place, I think we can then turn our attention to identifying what issues we might need to start coalescing around for a 2025 legislative policy and planning discussion.
Thank you very much, Chris. So, Madam Chair, that's our legislative update. I know that was a bit extensive, especially what I provided there. Really appreciate Chris's candor and the good representation that he and John and other members of the team provide us. Happy to take any questions that you and others may have.
Yes. Hi, this is Audrey Delnicki, South Windsor. Chris, what was that House bill number that you mentioned for the motor vehicle tax?
I believe it's 5172. Let me just pull up my note here. 5172. So okay. If you look at that bill, I don't have the kind of behind the closed door, explanation of what was going on. But this is one of those bills that ping-ponged between both chambers with kind of last-minute amendments on the closing days, and it ultimately didn't pass. There was, I think, some disagreement between the Senate and the House on what the language was going to be, and ultimately that didn't pass. What I understand is that, and maybe some of you even on this call might have some more insight than I do, there were some local assessor issues that were brought up, but I don't have clarity on exactly what that is or what the quote unquote fix will be. But this is the impetus for this issue is the impetus for the desire to come back into special session and fix.
But yeah, Chris, if I could just add briefly to your comments there. So part of the challenge here is that legislation approved a year ago, because a bill didn't pass this session, legislation approved a year ago that was found to have some complications now goes into effect. And some of the complicating factors are in terms of how commercial and other vehicles are valued. And it's really going to increase costs for local businesses, small businesses. So there's some great concern about that. And I see that Mr. Bowles has his hand up. Perhaps he can add to this, or he might have a related point to add.
Actually, mine was on a more general request of Chris as we're moving forward, but I can hold that until we're done with the underlying issue if you want. Or I'll go now. Chris, in thinking about the 25 legislative session, as I think you remember from when Kathy was still with your firm, we've been trying to become more proactive with CROG's legislative package, and I think we've certainly seen that over the last couple of sessions. My hope and is working with you and Matt and the legislative committee is we might be able to work earlier on what our legislative session is going to look like so that as the election comes into focus, we can hit the ground running a bit more precisely. I want to say strategically, but I think precisely is a better word in terms of what legislators we need to be talking to getting more of our legislation across the goal line. And I also understand that, you know, some of this stuff takes more than one session to get approved, but I think kind of sharpening our pencil and fine tuning our message earlier than when we typically have would serve us well. I just would throw that out there for your thoughts and for Matt's thoughts as well as we head into the summertime when everybody's going to either shift to campaigns or vacations.
I certainly think that's a point well taken, and especially, you know, in a 2-year election cycle, I think you kind of have different approaches in odd numbered years and even numbered years, but ultimately the goal is the same, right? You want to go in prepared and you want to have folks armed early with what our priorities are, because the longer you wait, the less likelihood you have to really have a good impact on. In even numbered years, in my experience, is that there's going to be not a whole lot of detailed policy talk and kind of rolling up the sleeves until after elections happen. We're going to have new committee assignments. We're going to have new members within the General Assembly. I don't expect we'll have as many new folks this upcoming term than we have the last two, but I still think there will be a number of new folks that will be in new places. You might have different committee chairmen. So some of those items really don't get locked down until November, but that doesn't mean that we don't have any ability to advocate or start pushing ideas in front of folks. In fact, I think election time is a really good opportunity to do that. In our CROG region, we have such a huge chunk of the General Assembly within our delegations. I think it's probably 40% or close to it of the General Assembly that's in our region. We have open seats in our region. We have incumbents running for re-election. They're communicating with their constituents. This is a good opportunity for us to articulate to them even before election on what some of the things are looking at. What are the things that we really need to change, and can we influence some of the messaging even in campaigns? That's certainly something that we'd be I think would be prudent to take advantage of. So to your point, getting some of that organized early and being able to talk about that while some of these incumbents running for re-election are on the campaign trail or some of the open seats, and educating them, those that are in our region, really good opportunity to do that, and a good opportunity to start that process early. When it comes down to actually having meetings and figuring out where bills are getting introduced, I don't think that happens until late November at the absolute earliest, but more likely December. But there's still things we can do before that.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you for raising that, Jason. Lori, Madam Chair, Lisa Thomas has a question.
Yes, Lisa.
Thank you. I just want to go back to the Medicaid reimbursement rates. It's my favorite thing to talk about. So in reading this, I thought that there was funding in them, that end of session use of ARPA dollars. Are some of those dollars being directed towards this issue or not?
That's what DSS is looking into. I spoke with their legislative director just a couple of hours ago. That's what they're trying to identify. They didn't make any general fund changes whatsoever. And on Medicaid more broadly, there's a two-part study. One part is already done to look at Medicaid rates overall, and the remainder of the Medicaid rates are being looked at in this off session with a report due. I believe it's January. I don't know if it's the beginning of January or the end of January of 25. From a House leadership perspective, the speaker did articulate that will be a priority to look at in the 2025 session for Medicaid rates overall. But there were no general fund changes in Medicaid this cycle. I think I could say that with almost 100% certainty. What's in that bill, Section 74 of the ARPA expenditure bill, included a provision that directed DSS to increase by that certain amount. I think it was $1.18, but within available appropriations. That within available appropriations is you know, I don't want to say it's sneaky because it's not the right word. I don't know what the right descriptor is. It's a catch-all that if they don't have the money to do it, they don't have to do it.
Thank you, Chris. And again, we're gonna follow up and we'll respond to Lisa's question and circulate that to the full board. I think Rob Eloise has a point. Rob?
Yeah, just a question for Chris. Saw a newspaper article this week indicating that they are allowing municipalities to enact automated noise enforcement on roadways. I was surprised to hear this. I hadn't heard any talk about it previously, and it seemed like it came through, the article said through the bond commission, and I wondered if what you knew about that.
That does ring a bell. I don't have that in my notes, but if you give me just 1 minute, I might be able to identify it quickly. I think, yeah, so automated enforcement, I was able to find it quickly. It's sections 132 to 136 of the bond bill, and it does allow municipalities to use noise cameras to issue citations to vehicles committing municipal noise violations. In doing so, it would require municipalities to seek to operate cameras to adopt an ordinance and set penalties. I haven't looked at that very carefully and prepared, you know, specific notes on it, but my recollection is that I think it's modeled similarly after last year, the year before's authorization for municipalities to do auto speed and red light enforcement. I think it's similar to that structure, but that is in the bonding bill, which is yet to be signed by the governor, and it's sections 132 to 136.
How does legislation come through the bonding bill in general?
Because it served as more of an implementer, like an omnibus bill this session. There's a lot that was folded on the end. All right. Well, thank you for the questions and comments. Thanks again, Chris. Madam Chair, if you want to move forward and close us out today.
Yes, we're all set on correspondence and handouts. Matt, letters of support.
Just a letter of support we provided to the town of Southington.
Okay, so I'll ask for number 19, a motion to adjourn.
So move.
Okay, second.
Second, Lisa Thomas.
Thank you.
We don't have a favor. Form, but you need to vote anyhow.
All right.
Bye.
Have a nice Memorial Day, everybody.
Thank you, everyone.
Happy Memorial Day. Thank you so much, Lori. And thank you, everybody who hung in there. Really appreciate it.
Hey, Matt, Greg Haddad says hi. Greg wanted me to say hi.